If you are planting once and walking away, I'm pretty much guarantee that project is destined to fail. The fundamental, the baseline is we absolutely have to have ongoing involvement with our planting site if we want it to become a self-sustaining forest. If you are seeing new species being introduced via birds or wind, I think for me that is a really good sign that, it's on its way to becoming self-sustaining. So it's no longer a revegetation planting, it's become habitat.
Hello, kia ora.
And welcome to the People Helping Nature podcast.
We're your hosts. I'm Anna.
And I'm Callum. And today we've got Wayne O'Keefe back on the podcast for a second time around to talk to us about planting native trees the right way. Welcome, Wayne. Welcome back.
Oh, thank you for having me back. It's good to be here again.
Well, look, you were one of the most enjoyed guests of our first tranche of episodes, so it is a real pleasure to have you back. And we have a lot of conversations offline around conservation, and so it's great to just profile some of your knowledge and wisdom on the show.
As Callum said, today's going to be about native tree planting. Would you like to introduce yourself for the people who haven't listened to that very first episode, with a particular focus on your involvement in the native tree planting space?
Yeah, certainly. So I've been working in conservation now for some 20 years, largely in the community conservation space, meaning that I support a lot of community initiatives. And I'm a big native plant geek through and through. I think that's well known. And as a result, I've been fortunate enough to be heavily involved with a lot of restoration plantings over the years. A lot of my work was done in the coastal strip, in restoring sand dunes and coastal forest. And I've also done restoration plantings elsewhere as well over the last 20 years. And at the moment, I, to be honest with you, I don't spend as much time on the spade as I would like these days. I'm kind of more in that advisory space now where, working with community groups to largely give them the best chance of success that they have with their planting projects. Because as we know, establishing a native forest is a very, very tricky thing to do.
That's awesome, Wayne. I feel like we're talking to the right person to dig into how to do a native tree planting. But before we get into that, why is it important to get it right? Why do we need to make sure that we set it up right from the start?
Ultimately, we want to see the goal realized. If we are out there planting, our goal is that those trees eventually become a sustainable native forest. So a lot of effort goes into that, a lot of human effort, a lot of resourcing, and also it's expensive to undertake as well. So I think we need to give those trees the best chance of success that they have.
So you've already touched a little bit on it, but really, what is a successful outcome for your native planting?
What does every single tree survive?
An ideal world, yes, but you are going to get attrition, you will get deaths regardless. Although I think if the right trees are chosen for the right place, there's no reason why you shouldn't get around a 90% survival rate, in my opinion and in my experience. So for me, a successful planting is one that has the best chance of becoming a self-sustaining planting, and will eventually evolve into self-sustaining native forest over the course of many, many decades. For me, that is what it's all about. It's not just about planting once and walking away. It's about having that ongoing involvement for sometimes as much as 20, 25 years to get that planting to a point where you can comfortably say, yep, I think it's tracking in the right direction, and I think it's going to largely start to look after itself to some extent. Mm.
Yeah, that's a good one. I think it's easy to focus on that hero moment when we put the tree in the ground and forget about it, whether it's for habitat or for biodiversity, for erosion prevention or for climate change and CO2 sequestration. Really, the largest benefits don't come when you put the tree in the ground. They come in the decades and ideally the centuries that follow.
I came up the other day with the 3P concept, and largely based on what you taught me, Wayne, which is pretty much the planning as a step one, my planting as the step two, and my final and probably biggest step of them all, it's the protection of that planting. And we were just really keen to talk through those steps with you so you can share from your experience and what that all involves, share tips, but also share what not to do.
So starting off with planning and before the planting day itself, what steps or what actions are involved in planning the project?
Well, as you can imagine, it varies from site to site. And I think that is fundamentally the mindset we need to develop, is we cannot be prescriptive about afforestation or replanting. We have guidelines that we work to, but we cannot be prescriptive, because in my experience, 50 meters is a heck of a long way when you're planting trees. You know, you can get quite big differences in very small spaces. So we only have guidelines, not prescriptions. For me, fundamentally, if I'm going to visit a site, the key things I'm looking for is identifying the threats. What are the threats that could potentially jeopardize this planting? So within that threats, I am looking at animal threats. Is the area, if it's on a farm, is the area well fenced and protected from stock? Are there deer in the vicinity? Are there rabbits or hares or wallabies or even possums? You know, so if they are in the immediate vicinity, straight away, you know you've got quite a bit of work to do before you even start planting. I'm also looking at the plant threats. What are the weeds in the wider landscape? And I see this so often, it's not a consideration. Because you can guarantee if you've got fairly nasty weeds in the area, and I'm thinking things like honeysuckle, jasmine, bindweed, convolvulus, pampas, woolly nightshade, those kind of, you know, those nasty weeds that can and will infiltrate a planting site. I'm looking to identify those, and I'm looking at, well, do I actually need to do some control outside of my planting area before I even consider planting? So in the past, I've been known to do 2 years worth of weed control in that area, even before we plant a tree. And I think vine weeds are especially bad around here. Honeysuckle is especially bad, and it will smother your planting literally in the course of a few months. On my drive from here to Tauranga, I'm regularly driving past an area that was planted last year, or probably a couple of years ago now, and initially it was looking really, really nice, really good growth, chose the right species. However, I noticed that outside of the planting area was a lot of honeysuckle. So now when I drive past this planting, the honeysuckle's gotten into the planting, it's starting to climb up the trees, it's starting to smother those trees. So I don't see much of a future for that planting project, you know, and that potentially could have been arguably around $10,000 cost to the landowner.
Wow.
Yeah. So I'm identifying animal threats, identifying plant threats, also looking at what resourcing is available, you know. So ideally you've got funding to see this project through. Well, you're not seeing it through, but you're involved in this project for at least 3 to 5 years. You want to make sure that you've got the resourcing to do any follow-up maintenance work, plug in any gaps. If you have attrition, you know, you can go back through and plug those gaps. So largely a project is driven by what level of resourcing is available. And unfortunately, the gold standard is never really made available to you. Quite often you only have funding for 1, 2, 3 years at the most. So those are sort of the things I'm looking at when I'm planning a project. Also looking at things like slope, aspect, hydrology. Also looking at what the soil type is like, because you will find that, you know, you can have varying degrees of, say different soil types within a planting zone. So you need to get a bit of a handle on being able to identify those. And often it's the plants that are growing there initially will give you clues as to what the soil is like underneath. For example, if you see creeping buttercup growing, you know this can be pretty wet underneath, you know, and things like that. So you're trying to take in as much information as possible, you know, on an initial visit or subsequent visits.
Yeah, I think that is such an important part of your planning that a lot of people overlook. I've been observing so many projects, and they get so hung up on, you know, do I plant them at half a meter apart or 1 meter apart, that they're so looking at that and forgetting what's actually around it or what the land's telling them.
Yeah, I was just going to say, you know, if you've got those sorts of weeds in the wider environment, you can bet your bottom dollar they're going to find their way into your planting site. So either your plan needs to, you know, include control of those weeds, or you need to take into account things like tree spacing as well, which I'm guessing we'll talk a little bit more about later on.
Yeah, and I think outside of the conservation space where you're actively considering these things, it's really easy to get into the trap of where you're going to plant as many trees as we can, rather than thinking, how do we make sure the maximum amount survive to maturity and they're the right trees for the ecosystem?
Yeah. I know it's become a little bit of a cliche now, but, you know, right tree, right place, right purpose.
Mm.
You know, can't stress that enough. Yeah. And you do need to have a fairly, you don't need to be an expert, you know, in ecological processes, but you need to have a fairly solid understanding of those ecological processes, especially when it comes to how the land heals itself naturally, you know? Because again, when you're looking at the cues that the environment is giving you, one of those cues is, well, it's telling you what to plant generally, you know? So if you've got regenerating farmland around you, for example, and you do have native grown with that, then it's a fairly good bet that if you choose those species, they're going to do well in your planting site.
Yeah, that's a really good point. So speaking of the site, what does it take to get the site ready for planting?
So my favorite places to plant are on well-maintained farmland. Because, you know, the farmer will usually do a pretty good job of keeping the weeds under control. You know, especially things like vine weeds and pampas and gorse. Those are my favorite places to plant, because you know that the weed loading within your planting site is going to be fairly low. Preparation can be fairly minimum there. At the other end of the spectrum, you've got a project site which is not is inundated with weeds, but the wider environment is inundated with weeds as well. And to be honest, you know, those are very, very challenging places to get native trees established, because those weeds in the periphery are going to be there for a mighty long time. So unless you've got the budget or the willpower or the human resources, they're going to be very, very difficult to maintain. So, yeah, again, you can't be prescriptive by this. Every site requires a slightly different approach based on those observations that you make.
So in general, what are the most common mistakes that you see people making through the planning stage, and how can other people on the journey avoid those?
I think probably the biggest one is underestimating the impact of maintenance, you know, potentially maintenance. Another one is I see a lot of is people not necessarily choosing the best species for the role. So they're not potentially not ecologically appropriate for that area, or they are not what we would call a pioneering species, which is generally the trees that we use. Not much thought put into wild animal control. You know, I've seen plantings being wiped out within a space of a couple of days because they didn't think that the rabbits would eat the plantings. I've seen a big totara plantation wiped out because they didn't make sure that their fence was sheep-proof. So a few sheep got in and bit the tops off every single totara tree. And this was meant to be a timber plantation, so you can imagine that worthless. Mm. Yeah, so I mean, that just a, you know, a short list really of mistakes that I see people do.
Aside from that, what are other key things that people need to consider? For example, a big one that I'd like to talk about is the species that you plant you need to be aware of to be successful.
So generally speaking, we will use what are called pioneering species. So these are largely species that if the land is left alone to heal itself, these are generally the species that will first emerge. Everyone will know Manuka and Kanuka. So we use those extensively in plantings because, you know, nature will give you a good cover of Manuka and or Kanuka when the land has been retired. And then we'll use a mixture of other shrub hardwoods, things like Kanono, Cryptosma robusta, Makomako, a wineberry. I use a little bit of Putaputaweta, which is the marble leaf. Even things like Tikoka and Harakiki have a place as well. What else? I mean, again, it's without wanting to be prescriptive, you know, depending on where you are in the country, you know, you would try and choose the same species that you would ordinarily see growing in that very early forest. And that will differ throughout the country.
So what you're saying is that there's a certain group of species that are like the first stage of the forest, but they're not going to be there as the forest gets older. Is that right? Or?
Yep. I think not enough thought is given to the end game. You know, what is the end game for this planting? And as it's mentioned earlier on, the end game needs to be self-sustaining forest. So how do we get that? We need to recognize that within that course, you know, that time frame, which could be 25, 50, 100, 200 years plus, there is an intergenerational phase that we need to go through. So these first tranche of plants that we're planting, the pioneering species, I've heard some people refer to them as Kohanga Nui as well. So what those trees are doing, they are providing that first, that immediate cover on the land, but also they are providing suitable conditions for the next generation of trees to flourish. And then what will happen is largely they will die away while their second flourish takes over, and onward until we reach a point what we call climax forest. So each generation of trees, if you like, is there to provide suitable conditions for the next generation of trees to come through.
If I said I want to get straight to the outcome, I want the climax forest, I'm going to put Tawa or Puketea or a lot of these species you see in established old growth forests straight into bare land, they're not going to survive, or will they struggle a bit where you should be planting like Manuka or the first stage instead?
Yeah, I mean, depending where you are, largely they will struggle. A lot of them will succumb to exposure and frost. It'll be very, very, very slow to grow if they do grow. I wouldn't recommend that. We need to follow where we can that natural process of, you know, having those healing plants and then working through intergenerationally to introduce those plants as the conditions allow, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I think in a way you're trying to mimic natural reforestation, but you're fast tracking it, right? Because usually when you're planting, the land that you're planting on has been in use otherwisely for so long that it needs a bit of a starting help, right? Is that essentially a good way to put it?
I think that's a really good way to put it, especially the fast tracking. You know, we are able to expedite the process, if you like, to get from, you know, early succession in forest right through to, you know, climax forest. We don't have to wait as long as the, you know, the natural processes would take. We can speed things up a little bit. And again, it's your approach would be different depending on the site. For example, if you're dealing with the next forestry block, if you've got native forest nearby, there's a mighty good chance that you're going to have a huge seed profile within that soil. So when those pine trees are logged, you know, more often than not, you'll get a really good flourish of native trees coming up.
Is that because they've just been like it might have only been a generation ago that it was native forest, so the seed base is still alive in the soil?
Yeah, potentially. I think we I don't think we know really what our native seeds are capable of doing in terms of, you know, dormancy. You know, I think a lot of the seeds are able to lie dormant for a mighty long time. Plus as well, you know, if you've got native forest nearby, you will have birds flying over and depositing fresh seed as well. Yeah.
Right. Wow, yeah, it's so tempting to think of native planting as black and white, but it's so far from that. It's there's so many influences from, yeah, like you said, the seed source to what the birds are doing to the surrounding weeds. Jumping to the planting day itself, this is obviously the part that everyone thinks about, but what does a planting day look like from start to finish?
So if I have done plantings as a contractor, and so I've had a contract team working alongside me. So that's generally quite a different approach to if I'm working with volunteers. You know, if I've got a contract gang working with me, then I'm very conscious of time. You know, I'm very conscious of that dollar value, so I'll take a slightly different approach. Most of my plantings, however, are with volunteer groups, so it just requires, again, a different approach. I'm a little bit of a control freak, if I'm to be honest, when it comes to plantings, because generally I am able to identify different ecotones, if you like, within a planting site. You know, so I might be able to identify a particularly wet area, or might be able to identify a particularly dry ridge, you know, with no topsoil. So those are going to require slightly different approaches. So if I see that, then I have been known to get a site a day earlier and actually lay out some trees myself. You know, so I have been known to do that. It's just that way you're ensuring you know, those trees have got the best chance of success.
I think that's the best approach because you've got the success, the outcome in mind. Most regular volunteers that show up to plantings days, they don't have that knowledge. So I feel like for everyone to have a good time and for the planting to be a success, you have to kind of set it up for that. And yep. I think laying out plants is a key thing on your planting day, providing that everyone has a good flow and later on, yeah, the right trees in the right spot.
Yeah, I think it's good. I think people appreciate it as well, you know, because it takes a lot of the guesswork out for them. And also can speed up the planting as well, you know, because one of the things you're very mindful of if you're running a volunteer event is you don't want burnout. Okay. Generally what I find is 2 hours is about, you know, about the limit, and then obviously you've got that social aspect afterwards as well, which is just so important. You know, make sure you put on some food and some drinks, and give them an opportunity to socialize and mix and mingle afterwards.
And I think what you just said is so true. I think planting alongside with trapping so often is their first interaction. I guess another guest labeled them as the gateway drug to conservation. So looking after them on the day and ensuring they have a good experience, I think that is really crucial and probably also translates in the quality of the planting. So are there any common mistakes other than what you already touched on that people really need to avoid on the planting day itself?
Yeah, it's just really, you know, don't, if you're working with volunteers, you know, don't push them too hard. Accept those limitations and accept there'll be a little bit of reworking to be done. So generally for me is when a planting is finished and the volunteers have left, I'm generally back on site. I'm a little bit of a walk around, make sure there are no trees left in their bags. If they're any sort of leaning over, just stand them up, make sure they're healed in or firmed in properly, that sort of thing. So I do my own little bit of quality control. I think that's really important.
Are there any other important things that we haven't covered so far that people need to keep in mind at the planting day to get the best results from it?
Timing obviously is a good one.
Obviously, yeah.
Do it. So I mean, that again depends on where you are in the country. You know, you will know peak planting time of where you are. If not, ask someone who's done a lot of planting in your area. Hey, what are our peak times for planting here? Frost is another consideration as well. You know, which again, touches on the planning side of things. It's very, very difficult to know. It's impossible to know when we're going to get frosts, right? You know, in some years we get very, very heavy frost. Some years we get quite light frost. So that's always a little bit of a fingers crossed scenario. Generally, try and choose trees that are not overly frost sensitive, but some of them are. So it's inevitable that, you know, some will get nailed by frost. That can be somewhat remediated if when you are choosing your trees, so this is fundamental, when you are ordering, when you've decided what trees you want to plant, okay, this is my selection, then you need to decide where you're getting your trees from. Buy your trees from a nursery as close to the planting site as possible. That is fundamental. That is just fundamental. I work with a number of nurseries here in the Bay of Plenty. I've got one They're quite close to the coast. I work with another one. They quite high up, exposed, and they get frosts. You know, so if I'm planting at the coast or close to the coast, I'm going to get my trees from the coastal nursery. However, if I'm planting inland, I'm planting at altitude, there's no way I'm going to bring trees from the coast to that situation, because they're going to say, what on earth have you done to us? I'm going to buy trees from a nursery nearby. I will try and look for trees that had a little bit of frost damage while they were at the nursery. You know, don't be tempted to get the nice, big, shiny, glossy green leaves. You know, I have been a few years ago, I went up to a nursery because I wanted a fairly big order of a particular species. And I wanted to see them before I committed to buying them. And so they took me out the back of the nursery and they showed me these lovely big green glossy plants. And I know these plants were quite frost sensitive. Behind them were these slightly gnarly looking plants. And I actually decided to get the slightly gnarlier looking plants rather than the nice shiny green ones, because I know the ones behind looking like they were because they had a little bit of frost damage. So I know that I'm taking those to site. Those trees have already experienced a little bit of frost. So there's more chance of them coping with frost than those ones that got, you know, lovely, soft, glossy green leaves. Price is not the only consideration. You have to give consideration to geography as well. It's fundamental, yeah.
That's fascinating. And when you say it, it seems like common sense, but it's easy not to think about that.
I've learned the hard way.
Yeah.
I feel like it's the opposite. Like, most people probably see a tree and they think, oh, nice and green, and they don't actually comprehend the cycles that are going on. And I think that's probably why we're seeing a lot of common mistakes being made, because planting is such a feel-good moment, I want to do something good. I feel often ways the planning is just cut short because lack of context, and people do learn the hard way. But also, once I've planted my planting area, is my job done? What's next?
Well, planting's the easy part, right? We know that. Then you have to look after them. So you can pretty much guarantee that you're going to get some level of weed ingress into your site. Depending on the size of the tree that you planted, one would hope that you've planted the biggest tree that you could afford and you haven't gone for a cheap seedling. You've gone for, you know, a decent size seedling or sapling. You're going to be dealing with likely rank grass within your planting site, weed incursion. So those trees will need some level of maintenance. And again, depending on your site, it could be just a couple of visits, two or three, four visits a year, hand releasing, or it could require quite a bit of chemical warfare, depending on the amount of weeds you are seeing in your site. So preparation is really, really important. I talk about preparation quite a lot. Again, we're in this a little bit of a mindset where we think, okay, I am planting, so therefore I have to spray prior to planting. For me, spraying, when I say spraying, I mean sort of, you know, spot spraying. So you spray a little 1 square meter area prior to popping your tree in. For me, even spot spraying is a last resort. I've observed this over the years, in that we know that nature loves a vacuum. We know that with predator control. It also, the same applies in the plant kingdom as well. So fundamentally, if we kill off a patch of grass, something is going to want to recolonize that area. If you're lucky, it's just more grass, but more often than not, it'll be things like inkweed and bindweed, convolvulus, pretty gnarly thistles. So potentially all things that could make your life quite difficult when it comes to maintenance. However, where I can, my philosophy is to disturb the ground as little as possible. So that's why I said earlier on, retired farmland is my favorite place to plant, because you know, the weed loading is quite low. Generally, you're dealing with a rye clover pasture mix down here anyway. So you know that rye grass is never really going to overtake your plantings, not if you choose, you know, a decent sized sapling or seedling to start with. Kaikuyu, that's a totally different story. That's a totally different story. I have seen people that have blanket sprayed an entire area prior to planting. So the area was rye clover and it was pretty darn clean. They blanket sprayed the entire area prior to planting. And then there was just this flush of weeds, pepper plants and inkweed, to the point where the plantings were swamped. And this particular landowner had to invest, you know, a good $5,000 or $6,000 in contracted time to keep on top of the weeds. Whereas if they had just planted into the right clover, there's a good chance they wouldn't have had to do much less maintenance. So again, don't automatically assume you have to spot spray. Consider what would happen if I didn't spot spray, you know, as well as what would happen if I did spot spray, because nature does love a vacuum. So it's always a last resort for me. And where I can, now I'll advocate for a no spray approach where I can.
Right. So a lot of the post care requirements are going to depend on what you saw in the pre-prep and how well you did your pre-prep.
I mean, it's like anything in life, right? There's a series of decisions that you have to make, you know, and quite often you have to pay the consequences for a decision that you made prior. And I think for a lot of people, that that fundamental in that planning stage is what level of site maintenance or site preparation do I need to do? Because let's face it, most plantings are occurring on retired farmland. We ourselves, right, we were at a planting together last winter on a planting site where the landowner decided to do no spot spraying. And the weed load in that site was negligible as a result. You know, whereas we know where, because, you know, he built a new fence around that planting site, and you could see where they bulldozed the track for the new fence. That was just thick with inkweed. So we know there's a lot of inkweed seed in that soil. So if he had spot sprayed, potentially around every single native seedling, there would have been at least one inkweed. And inkweed's got the potential to stop, you know, a native seedling in its tracks. It'll just smother it. Yeah. So he made a really, really, really smart decision there, because he knew his farm. He knew how his farm would react, you know, to being sprayed.
So it's essentially, it's really know your site. If you don't know a lot about plantings, probably get your advice early. And what I'm hearing you say quite a lot is, in your planning phase, consider the consequences of the action that you're proposing. And the other one that I really want to point out as well, to protect your planting after you've planted the trees, and you've already said it before, put your animal protection up before, because I've seen it a few times as well, where the planting was done, the grazers were forgotten about, and it was again rabbits. And that planting is now a monoculture of Nioh trees, because that was the species that the rabbits decided were too unpalatable. It's a big thing to tackle right now, is to get that right again.
It is, and rabbit control is very, very challenging, especially on farmland, you know, because although, you know, you could argue you could night shoot, and you can fumigate burrows, you could bring dogs in. Fundamentally, the toxin is the best way to get rid of rabbits. And being a working farm, it's very difficult to, you know, to lay toxin to make sure you meet the requirements. So, yeah, I think if you do have a rabbit infestation on a particular site, then you need to work really, really hard in controlling those rabbits prior to planting, or accept that you're going to have a much more expensive planting because you're going to need to buy tree guards to go around those trees. So that's another option as well. And often that is the most palatable option. On that, though, again, you talked just now, you talked about cause and effect, right? Which that's what conservation is about, right? It's cause and effect. If I do this here, what's going to happen over there? Even something simple like rabbit guards, you know? I used some a number of years ago. This was before the Hessian ones were available and the card ones were available. Back then, they were all made of core flute. So I used these in a site where I just could not get on top of the rabbits. And I went back to check on the plantings a little while later, and I had lost most of the palatable plants within those tree guards, not to rabbits, but to slugs and snails. It was the Corfu tree guards provided the perfect habitat, beautiful, lovely, and warm for slugs and snails. So, yeah, sometimes you can't win. I will say this about rabbits, though, is that they hate long grass. So I've been able to utilize rank grass to great effect in a planting where I know there are rabbits. It's just too difficult to control for various reasons. So we have planted into rank grass and protected them from the rabbits.
Wow, interesting. There's a lot of factors at play that influence how successful the planting is, but do we know on average what percentage of native trees planted make it to adulthood, to maturity?
I wouldn't know. I wouldn't like to hazard a guess because we're not very good at monitoring our plantings. You know, and that's something that needs to be factored in to any planting project is a good, solid monitoring regime. And it doesn't have to be overly onerous. Trees the Count and Tarnish Tree Trust have developed a really straightforward way of monitoring a planting site. And it's really, really valuable because it tells you what species you are losing at that particular site. So in subsequent years, if you are going to be planting, you know, if it's, say, a planting project over the next 5 years, what you learn in year one can affect what you do in year four or year five. Because if you're finding you're losing one particular species for some reason, then you think, well, okay, maybe it's not the right species for this site. So I think I would recommend everyone to just put in some form of monitoring of your planting so you know what is doing well and you know what species aren't doing so well.
So how do you monitor? Is there like a numerical method or do you just have a look over the land and say, I can see more of the species and it's a bit taller than this one? Or
There's various ways to do it. I mean, it can be as informal as formal as you want. Informally, you're doing a quick walkthrough, you know, making a note of any gaps in your plantings, although that doesn't necessarily tell you what species was growing there. Photo points are absolutely fantastic way to monitor. The Tarnish Tree Trust, the Trees of Crown, have developed their methodology where you are putting in sample plots throughout your planting. So essentially it's a 10-meter circle. So you've got a center point and a 5-meter string from that center point. Essentially just walk around in a circle, making a note of what species you've encountered, i.e. what species the string has hit. You make a note of the height, the species, and how strong it is, you know, or whether it's been browsed. So it's really simple. Anyone can do it, you know, and then that's repeatable. So you'll do that, you know, every year. Pretty soon you build up a picture of what's working and what's not working on your site.
So really it's about I plant my tree and I don't forget about it. I come back, I release the individuals, but I also have a look at it, bigger picture of what's happening across the site.
Yeah, definitely what's happening across your site. Because that's really important because one would hope that you have, you know, a long-term involvement with that site. If you are planting once and walking away, you can pretty much guarantee that project is destined to fail, for want of a better word. Especially if, again, getting back to the planning side of things is you have to determine how many trees per hectare you want or what the spacings of your trees is going to be. So depending on who you talk to, it can vary anywhere from 1.5 meters to 3 meters, which is cool. You know, so again, is understanding the signs that you've seen at your site, the observations that you have made will also determine what your tree spacing is. So what do I mean by that? So, for example, if you've got a really clean landscape, again, you know, say a farm in Hawke's Bay where there's barely a weed to be seen, you could potentially get away with planting your trees a little bit further apart and just wait a little longer for them to grow up and touch shoulders and start creating shade. However, if you're in quite a weedy site, you want to be thinking about bringing those trees in a little bit closer, maybe even down to 1.5 meters. The reason being there's a good few of the pest plant species will not tolerate shade. So in those early years, the goal is to get as much shade as quickly as possible, get those trees touching shoulders so they can start to throw shade and not only start to shade out a lot of the weeds, but also to start providing suitable conditions for the next generation of trees. However, again, it's not simple. It comes with a caveat that if you plant your trees at 1.5 meter spacings, you will absolutely have to go in and do some gardening in there because you will probably find that it'll be too dark underneath for those next generation of trees to come through. So again, it's about the long-term involvement with a project site. So if you've gone in and you've done your first year's worth of planting. You've got those sort of pioneering species established, your manuka, your kanuka, and your shrub hardwoods, and they're pumping. Year two, year three, you're starting to think about, okay, well, they are pumping now. They provide a nice little bit of shelter, you know, in that planting site. What can I now think about introducing, you know? So now you're looking at maybe, I could maybe introduce some river. This is Bay of Plenty specific, you know. Maybe I could introduce some river. Maybe I could introduce some porokai fruit, you know, into that mix because you've got a little bit of shelter around them. And then you've got to be thinking, well, where am I at after 3 to 5 years? Well, after 3 to 5 years, you could potentially be introducing those rangatira, those raka rangatira, you know, your rimu and your puri and your koi and those sorts of trees. So those trees that you'll see in Climax Forest, you can start introducing those. But again, I've been able to introduce those trees at some sites after just 1 year, you know, wow, because the conditions have been right, you know. Whereas some sites, you may be waiting 3 to 5 years before you're confident the conditions are right to introduce those later successional trees. So again, it's not prescriptive. However, the fundamental, the baseline is we absolutely have to have ongoing involvement with our planting site if we want it to become a self-sustaining forest. The projects that I've walked alongside and I've seen that have become successful in that, you know, you can see, you think, yes, this is tracking towards a self-sustaining forest. You can bet your bottom dollar that there's been at least 20 to 25 years of involvement at those sites.
Wow.
That is arguably what is required at many sites to get it through, you know. We've got to get away from this notion of planting once and walking away. We've got to find the ability and the resourcing to be involved with that site for potentially decades to come.
Yeah, I guess the plant and walk away approach is definitely, like you say, you're setting yourself up for a fairly high percentage rate of going to fail. So I feel that us as a conservation sector, we have to acknowledge that long-term game. And I feel like there's lots of work to do in educating and providing enough funding if we get approached to set up person XYZ for success.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
With the funding side of things, we need to look beyond the three-year cycles as well. Like if we're doing a planting, should we then be saying it might be less per year, but you're going to get annual funding for 20 years to see this through?
Yep, that would be great. Minimum 5 years, you know, even in your mainstream funding space. But ideally, you know, if we can get into a paradigm where we are, you know, supporting these plantings for 15, 20 years. In some cases, that's what is needed. Mm. I mean, the Awaho Care Group Restoration Planting in Rotorua is a classic example. I mean, they've done wonders there, absolute wonders, to turn a wasteland of weeds back into a fully sustaining native forest. It's taken them 25 years and thousands of hours of volunteer labor and support from regional council, neighbors, landowners, you know. So I think we underestimate the level of commitment that is involved. Let's just say that.
After 20, 25 years or however long, what changes that you can suddenly back off?
Oh, I think that's a really good question and a little bit difficult to answer. But I think if you are seeing new species being introduced via birds or wind, I think for me that is a really good sign that, you know, it's on its way to becoming self-sustaining. You know, if, I think it's the natural introduction of successionary species. You know, so if, for example, you've got a planting that, you know, 10 or 12 years old, and all of a sudden you start to see rimu seedlings popping up or something like that, I think you're well on your way then to becoming native forest. Yep.
So essentially, it's other life forms such as birds coming in, using the habitat you created and spreading seeds from elsewhere, or would it be stuff that's still in your soil?
No, you're right, it's coming from elsewhere, you know, so you're getting your insects and your birds. And I think you made a good point there. So it's no longer a revegetation planting, it's become habitat. So I think that's a really nice way to put it, Anna. Yep.
So should we then be fast tracking birds bringing the seed source in to move towards that successful successionary outcome faster?
Yep, definitely. So there's this thing called assisted regeneration. I don't know if you've come across it, but it's something that's gaining a lot of traction and understanding. And essentially that is allowing the natural processes to occur and supplementing that with some additional planting, but also predator control. So, you know, predator control is essential to any assisted regeneration or natural regeneration. It absolutely has to be predator control. I do hear this narrative that, you know, if we plant, an area of, say, Manuka or Kanuka, and we're just going to let the birds do the rest of the work. I'm not entirely convinced on that narrative, to be honest, because, again, there are too many variables at play. A, there needs to be native forest nearby. B, there need to be birds within that forest, and there's only going to be birds within that forest if there's predator control. We know how silent our forests are without predator control. And so it's not just, it's easy to say, you know, we let the birds do the work. They will do a considerable amount of work, but we need to think about how we can help them to help them do the work, you know. And obviously predator control is a main reason or a main way we can help them.
It's really, really fascinating. And I guess it brings up a question of, when can we consider a native planting a success, or when can we consider that we can expect the birds and invertebrates to come back? How do we judge the success of the planting?
I think that the success of the planting is largely driven by what the outcome, the desired outcome was of that planting, fundamentally. You know, so I think it gets back to the planning stage. You know, what is the outcome of this planting? I've done plantings that have been for amenity value only, because the council wanted some shade trees. So to my mind, the success of that project is when the trees are throwing shade. I've done planting for infrastructure protection. You know, so the outcome is that we want to be able to protect roads and buildings. You know, so I think it depends largely on the outcome. Some plantings, for example, are for honey production. So, you know, a successful outcome is when they start flowering. So I think it depends largely on what the desired outcome is. But think that most people plant because they want to see, you know, native forest. That is a tricky one to answer.
How clear are we on our desired outcome at the outset then? Is that something most people know what they're wanting to get out of the planting? Or is that something that we need to work on?
Absolutely. I think absolutely is to do a little bit of, you know, soul searching as well. What do I actually want from this planting? You know, and I think it's especially the case for riparian planting. You know, I think we still have a lot of improvement to make in that riparian planting space. I don't think we've quite nailed it yet. You know, so I think we need to have a think about what does effective riparian planting look like. A lot of riparian planting I've seen, in fact, a lot of plantings as a whole, we are largely setting the landowner up to fail. You know, so we are actually enabling this behavior, if you like, you know, and saying to them, well, if you put a fence, let's say a meter and a half away from a water course, and then you plant it up with the natives, it's going to be tickety-boo. No, it's not, you know, because largely a meter and a half is not really wide enough strip to be self-maintaining. You know, you're always going to have high levels of light through there, so therefore you're going to get weed ingress. You know, so you're setting that farm up for a lifetime of maintenance, essentially. You know, so I think we, especially as advisors, we've got to be really careful what advice we give, because we don't want to be enabling. You know, sometimes you've got to give a landowner a hard truth. I can relay a scenario here where this was a friend of mine, actually. He was advised by the local council to retire 7 areas on his farm, and they were going to provide the trees free of cost. He would just have to plant them and maintain them. So he just asked me to come around and look at the plan. And I did some quick sums, and it would have meant that he had a tree every 6 meters, you know, in these retirement areas. So you can imagine that at 6 meter spacings, those trees ain't ever going to touch shoulders. They're never going to be thrown any shade. And knowing that his farm was prone to blackberry, I could just imagine, you know, what would happen to those areas. In 18 months after planting, they would just be riddled with blackberry, and again, setting them up to fail on a lifetime of maintenance and giving native afforestation a bad name as well. So what we did, we actually condensed from 7 sites down to 1 site and just made sure we planted that 1 site really, really well. Rather than planting 7 sites poorly, plant 1 site really well. You know, and I drive past it on a regular basis now, and it's starting to look really good. You know, the plants are touching shoulders, they're starting to throw shade. The blackberry's getting a little bit weaker in places.
It sounds like, and I feel like our conversation is always coming back to the similar point, is that underestimating of the planning and the protection, and underestimating knowledge of the site, and possibly being a little bit unrealistic about how to achieve the outcomes. So to me, education and good advice is key here. How can people set themselves up for success? Like, what would be your advice for people who are thinking about doing some planting to avoid that maintenance trap?
There's always going to be a level of maintenance, right? You know, there's no getting away from that, but you can certainly work to minimize the level of maintenance. I think importantly, regional councils are pretty good generally. You know, pretty good resource to call on. Talk to other groups or other farmers that are planting, because, I mean, they'll be very, very open to, you know, sharing their journey, you know, their learnings, if you like, where they went wrong and what worked. I'm going to put a plug in for Tarnish Tree Trust website. They have recently updated all their fact sheets relating to afforestation and assisted regeneration. So it's absolutely fantastic resource. And just try and seek as much knowledge and information as possible before you embark. It's like anything, really. You know, do your research. Don't just jump in boots and all. Even talk to your nursery person. You know, get some insights from them as to what generally works in that area, what doesn't. Even call in a contractor for a couple of hours. You know, if you want to do the planting yourself, that's fine, but there are plenty of people out there in your area who will have that expertise, and that advice could well set you on your way.
Essentially save you a lot of money and grief in the long run.
Especially a lot of money, because, you know, fundamentally, you're looking at anywhere from $10,000 up to $40,000 per hectare, you know, to get native trees established. So it's not cheap. It is not cheap. Yeah.
It's funny just hearing you talk about all these important points along the whole journey of planting a native forest, from the pre-prep to the planting on the day to all the post-care actions, and thinking about what is your outcome that you want. I can't help but think of this like building a website. It's like, if you just say, I want a website, and you don't think about beforehand, what's the purpose? Who am I talking to? What's the goal of this? And afterwards, you don't think, how am I actually going to get people to the site? How am I going to improve it once people see it? Then it's just really a waste of time. And I see so many people as a marketer saying, I want a website, and just jumping on the quickest, cheapest, easiest option, and then regretting it 6 months later. And I think that's a really good analogy for what we're talking about here, is if you're going to plant native trees, be intentional about it and think beforehand about strategically, where am I planting, what prep is needed on the site, what trees, what's the surrounding landscape on the day, making sure it's done right, and then afterwards really making sure that you get the most out of that, because ultimately it comes to outcomes instead of output. Like, what are we trying to achieve instead of what activity are we doing? Is that a fair assumption? Or
absolutely, I think it's like any project, really, right? You know, whether any project, you have to have a clear path through to that outcome. You know, what is your objective fundamentally? And everything leads to that. And for afforestation, it stems from the dollar value available essentially, or the amount of human resourcing required, you know, i.e. Yeah. volunteer input, i.e. landowner input. And just getting that messaging out there that it's a heck of a lot of work to get native forests established. I mean, we're trying to do something that takes, you know, a couple of hundred years essentially of, you know, natural process. So you know, we're still learning. There's still quite a lot to learn. But I think we are getting better. You know, I'm seeing a lot more plantings now around the place where you can see, look, they've thought about it. You know, they've taken into account what the surrounding environment is like in terms of weed loading or pest animals. And so, yeah, I'm seeing a lot more thought and consideration placed on those sorts of things. So it's promising. Whereas, you know, there's only maybe 15 years ago, a lot of plantings that we've seen, especially around here, would be almost monocrops of certain trees, you know, because fundamentally that was what the nursery had at the time, and that was what was cheap. So there was little regard placed on the ecological process needed more. Okay, what can I afford to buy? Well, see, they've got 500 pittosporums free, going cheap. I'll buy all those and pop all pittosporums in, not knowing that they're quite short-lived trees and they don't really give way to the next generation of trees. Quite like Manuka and Kanaka do.
That's, I'm glad that there's positive change over the years. And now fast forward in that, what would you like to see change for the next, I guess, 15 years or so? So especially looking at those riparian plantings and connecting existing habitat, which seems to be happening all over the place. What's your dream outcome there for how we should tackle that as a nation?
Ooh, I think fundamentally, initially, has to be funding. You know, we've got to get the funding model right. We must make funding available to, you know, people doing this sort of thing for, you know, 10, 15, 20 years. We're very lucky to have organizations like Trees That Count, you know, supporting these initiatives, because without the likes of Trees That Count, you know, we'd be in a much worse place, if you like. Also, consider the role that individual trees could play in the landscape. You know, we don't necessarily always have to have a continuous swathe of trees. You know, consider the role that even just putting, you know, individual trees or small groups of trees across your farm could do. You know, it's much easier to maintain, easier to manage. And also, dare I say it, consider the role that exotic trees could play as well. We're talking about habitat connection and habitat corridors. Consider the role that exotic trees could play as well. Yeah. I mean, obviously, I'm not talking about, you know, weedy trees, but there are, I think, some exotic trees that have the potential to play quite key roles in habitat connectivity while still enabling a farmer to do his work and farm.
That's fascinating. I feel like we've talked about a lot today, but we're only scratching the surface of it. Let's say someone wants to find out more, they want to get active. What are their next steps? Where would you point people?
So if they want to understand the fundamentals of afforestation and assisted regeneration, I think you'd be hard-pushed to go past the Tarnais Tree Trust website and look at their fact sheets on there. Also, if you can identify any groups in your area or any landowners that you know have been doing it, yeah, just go and have a chat with them.
Thank you for sharing that. I think it's so important to remember that you're never alone on that journey. I'm glad you came on to just talk about the generics of tree planting, common mistakes, how we can do better, and essentially how to mimic nature to ultimately create habitat.
Thank you for the invite. I've enjoyed it. And I guess this comes with a caveat that this is based on my personal experience, you know. So wherever you are in the country, you will have a different set of guidelines to work by, you know. So don't take my word as being law. Just view them as guidelines to consider when you are entering into a afforestation project.
Yeah, that's a good caveat to put in there. Well, thanks for coming on, Wayne. Really appreciate it. Kia ora.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Kia ora.
Cool. Cheers.